It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Between the 1930s and 1960s, northern universities became destinations for black students from the South looking for the kinds of opportunities they didn't have access to back home. The process of integrating Iowa's public universities was long and slow, and black athletes and artists were among the first students to cross the academic color line. The new book, Invisible Hawkeyes, African Americans at the University of Iowa During the Long Civil Rights Era, tells the stories of many of the black students who were among the first to study at the University of Iowa. The editors of the book are Lena and Michael Hill. They'll be joining us in just a few minutes. But first, Dora Martin Berry traveled from Houston, Texas to Iowa City during the summer of 1955. She came to study theater at the University of Iowa, and in addition to her academic pursuits, she also became the first African-American student to win the Miss State University of Iowa contest. Her story is featured in the book, and she is with me now. Hello, Dora.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here today.
I'm glad to be here.
And let's travel back in time to 1955. As a student in Houston, Texas, a high school student, what drew you to the University of Iowa?
I had a guidance counselor who knew of my interest in theater and steered me to another teacher at one of the other black high schools in town, who was working on a graduate degree in the theater at the University of Iowa. She knew that. She sent me over to talk with him. And at the same time, I learned of several of my classmates who were headed to the University of Iowa. Those two factors, that did it for me. That made the decision. I had very little information that would steer me anyplace else. So Iowa...
Wow. Well, and that's a long way from home. And I know you were the first person in your family to go to college. Traveling 1,000 miles to do it, that must have felt like a really big leap.
It was indeed. But, you know, looking back, I was so young and so naive. I was just overwhelmed with the excitement of the adventure, and I didn't really begin to fully appreciate what a big leap this was until I was actually here.
All right. Well, you took the train and you traveled up here. You mentioned several other students from Houston, but what, three other students from Houston?
Yes, from my same high school.
All right. So there was this little group of the four of you traveling up together. When you got here, you moved into the dormitory?
Yes, Currier Hall.
And I know that Currier Hall had been, I guess, integrated in the fairly recent history at that point. There weren't that many African-American students at the University of Iowa, period. Paint me a picture. What was it like moving into Currier Hall?
Well, you know, part of my naivete was I was totally unaware of the history of black students on this campus. I came with the expectation that I was coming out of the South into the free North, and everything was going to be totally different. Well, that myth was soon ruptured. But I have to say, in Currier, the women were very welcoming, and I really felt I had a warm reception there. However, the number of black women in the dorm was quite small. We formed our own little community there. The women who had been here the previous year, and there was one who was a senior. They corralled us all pretty early on to kind of give us the inside scoop and show us the ropes. And that bonding that took place between the women in the dorm was our first step toward becoming oriented to this new environment that we were in.
And coming to Iowa, I mean, not only were you one of very few African-American students, but I am positive, given the lack of racial diversity in the state of Iowa, especially during that time, that for a lot of the students you were living with, you were the first African-American person they had ever met.
Oh, I know that is true. In fact, there were some who were honest enough to tell me as much. And I think a lot of their enthusiastic welcoming was out of curiosity as much as anything, you know, because they had grown up in, you know, parts of the state where there were no minorities of any stripe. So having someone so up close gave them an opportunity to really satisfy a lot of their questions and curiosities.
How did that feel to you? I mean, I'm sure a lot of that curiosity was well-meaning, but did it also reinforce for you the fact that you were part of a very small community?
That was part of the awakening. Absolutely.
How were you welcomed in the classroom?
You know, I don't have any memories of negative experiences in the classroom. One of the memories that is most vivid is the huge lecture halls.
Which is something a lot of freshmen at the University of Iowa
goodness.
Are overwhelmed by. Yeah, a sea of humanity.
Yeah, and then we, you know, the smaller discussion groups. I have to say that for the most part, those experiences were, there was nothing that stood out. Especially about them.
Let's talk about becoming Miss State University of Iowa. So
okay.
This is kind of like homecoming queen. The position.
Well, actually, homecoming queen was a separate
okay.
event.
All yeah. right. So, but there was a pageant that went along with this?
Yes.
And what made you want to enter the pageant?
You know, I didn't. It wasn't my choice. Here's how the system worked. The women in each housing unit chose their candidates to represent their dorm or their sorority house. And after all of the eliminations were done, there were 29 candidates. Courier, being the largest women's unit on campus, had the largest number of candidates. I think there were 12 of us from Courier.
Wow.
The women from – I was on 4 South. In Courier. So the women in my section of the dorm nominated me as their candidate. Each section had somebody. And then there was a runoff within the dorm. And the 12 finalists, if you will, from the dorm then joined the bigger group of candidates. And for campaign week, we went around to all of the men's housing units to campaign. And that culminated with voting. That year it was on December 9th. The following night, December 10th, the Fire and Ice Ball, that's when the winner was supposed to be announced and the crowning would take place.
All right.
Because the results were so astonishing, word leaked out. I got a call from an AP reporter at about 11 o'clock that morning notifying me that I had indeed won, and I couldn't grasp it.
So this became a news story before you were even told.
It did. It did.
And the news story was big.
It was very big.
How big was it?
Oh, I received newspaper clippings from as far away as Africa. I remember one in particular from Copenhagen, and of course from all of the 48 states.
Wow! So yeah. This was a big deal for you. It was a big deal for your friends at the University of Iowa. It was a big deal as a news story. How did you feel about it?
I was overwhelmed. I have to tell you that over time, I have come to really appreciate just how big a deal it was. at the time, I was 17 years old. I was just a kid, you know, and I was not looking at the big picture. I was focused on the moment.
Right.
In retrospect, I now see, I mean, this was all taking place. Brown v. Board of Education had just happened in 1954. Rosa Parks was arrested on December 1st for refusing to give up her seat to a white passenger in Montgomery, Alabama. December 1st, our voting took place on December 9th. Wow. I mean, at the time, I was not thinking about the context. But now, looking back, the context is everything.
Yeah.
That's what made this. And that's why the rest of the world was responding as they did. You know, they were looking at the University of Iowa and saying, look at all this other stuff is going on. And they have an environment in which this could happen. Unfortunately, the university was not as open and receptive as the rest of the world seemed to think they would be.
We will get to that part of the story in a moment because we are going to have to take a short break. But before we go to the break, so you received your crown at the Fire and Ice Ball?
I did.
What was that moment like?
You know, I had been smiling all day so big that by that time my smile muscles were just gone. And the cameras were flashing. There was this one color photograph that appeared in Look magazine. And I looked like I had a plastered, glued-on smile. That's all I could muster by
that
time.
That's all that you had left. All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking to Dora Martin-Berry. She was a student at the University of Iowa in 1955, became the first African-American student to win the Miss State University of Iowa contest, a victory that, as we will learn in just a moment, was also touched with heartache as well. I'm talking today with the editors of Invisible Hawkeyes, African-Americans at the University of Iowa during the long civil rights era, and we will continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, our conversation is inspired by the new book, Invisible Hawkeyes, African Americans at the University of Iowa during the long civil rights era. In just a few minutes, the editors of the book, Lena and Michael Hill, will be joining us. There are a number of events this week in Iowa City surrounding this book and these conversations as well. Tonight at 5 p.m. at Hanscher Auditorium, an event that we'll give people an opportunity to talk about the stories that are shared in this book. That's at 5 tonight. Tomorrow evening, there's a book signing at Hanscher Auditorium at 6:30. On Friday at the Iowa City Public Library, another opportunity to explore these stories and find out what this history was like between 3 and 6 p.m. at the Iowa City Public Library. You can find out more if you look for Invisible Hawkeyes online. And okay, just before the break, I was talking to Dora Martin-Berry. She's one of the women who tells her story in this book. She came from Houston, Texas to Iowa City during the summer of 1955 to study theater, and she also then was elected the very first African-American Miss State University of Iowa. And Dora, just before the break, we were talking about when you got that crown at the Fire and Ice Ball. And suddenly the eyes of the world were on you. There were stories, international stories, about what happened. But the University of Iowa responded in a negative way to what had happened. You went home for holidays pretty much right after this, right?
The Christmas holiday came very soon mm-hmm. after that, yes.
And when you returned to the University of Iowa, now this role, Miss State University of Iowa, had a lot of responsibilities throughout the year, things that you were looking forward to. When you got back to the University of Iowa, what did you find?
Actually, I found out before I left.
Okay.
There was an article in the Daily Iowan on December 16th announcing the university's plan for choosing who would go to the Rose Bowl representing the university. And they...
And this is something that Miss State University of Iowa should have been doing.
Absolutely.
You would have been on the float in the parade.
Absolutely. And their decision was to have the previous homecoming queen take that position instead. And for the next 2 years, so it would remain.
So
that was the first clue I had,
all right,
that things were going to be different.
When you found that out, did you understand what was going on?
I didn't really grasp all of it. It wasn't until after I came back from Christmas vacation. And then I learned that the next event, it was a Big Ten event, and it was something that had happened annually. It was canceled. And after that, nothing. I was never representing the university as Miss University of Iowa in any event.
So that fire and ice ball was the beginning and the end of it.
Correct.
Did anybody ever explain this to you? Did the university talk to you?
No. I never had any contact from the university at all.
How did you respond? How did you feel? I mean, you didn't necessarily fully understand what they were doing, at least not for a while, but...
No, it took a while for it to sink in, but with the help of my peers... I gradually began to grasp what was really going on. You know, my perspective on it is there was nothing they could do that would diminish what we had achieved. It was a community coming together. I mean, the black community, all of us. And there weren't many of us. I think less than 100 students, graduates, undergraduates, men and women. So for us to achieve that at that time, given everything else that was going on around us, there was nothing the university could do that would diminish that. And that's what I chose to focus on.
You did not stay and graduate from the University of Iowa. And I know that there were things in your life that took you other places. You did go
right
on to have a distinguished career, and you did finish college for your grandma and for you.
Yes.
But did that make it easier to leave the University of Iowa? The fact that, you know, you had this moment, but then the university didn't back you up.
It did. And it definitely affected how I thought about my relationship with the university over time. And in addition to my own experience, my husband had some very negative experiences as an athlete here. He was on the baseball team, and he shared with me experiences he had, which I was totally unaware of at the time. It was only years later, after we were married and we began to share our similar experiences that I learned those things. So my affinity for the university was definitely diminished by the sum total of our two experiences.
You did, much later on, receive recognition from the University of Iowa for that achievement, for being elected Miss State University of Iowa. That was many years later. Was that in the 80s or the 90s?
I'm not sure what you're referring to, because I don't remember any.
Well, there was... You made sure to note in telling your story, right, in 1998, during one of your reunions.
Oh, yes.
There was a plaque. But that was from the Iowa Black Alumni Association,
yeah,
not from the university.
It was not from the university.
Okay. And that's an important distinction. There was never an apology offered to you.
Never. No.
But never even an acknowledgement that this happened? Okay.
No.
Wow. How does that feel now? So many years later. I know you've made peace with so much of this.
Given everything else that I now know about our history here, you know, it's like just take a spot in the line, because there are so many others who experienced much worse, really.
Well, I want to find out about some of those others. Dora Martin Berry studied at the University of Iowa in 1955. She became the first African-American student to win the Miss State University of Iowa contest. And stay with us, Dora. But I also want to bring the editors of this book into the conversation. Lena Hill is senior associate to the president and associate professor of English and African-American studies at the University of Iowa. Hello, Lena.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here.
I'm so happy to be here, Charity.
And Michael Hill, associate professor of English and African American Studies at the University of Iowa, the co-editors of this book, and you also wrote some of the book as well, but brought together chapters written by other scholars as well. And so paint us a picture. I mean, we talked about Dora's specific experience back in 1955, but this book covers a period roughly between the 1930s and the 1960s, and also explores kind of a unique relationship between these public universities in the North and the students in the South. So help us understand what was going on. Why did these universities become something of a destination for Black students?
Yes, well, it's wonderful to talk about this as we listen to Dora give her personal account, because so much of what Michael and I have learned has been through research and through talking to students who actually attended during this time. It really is an interesting moment in history. As many states found themselves under really duress, and that the NAACP was bringing cases, noting that these states were not following what Plessy v. Ferguson actually said had to happen, and that was that you either had to provide an institution where African American students could attend or allow them access, separate but equal. And as these institutions found that they didn't want to do that, they would often give funds to African-American students to pursue their education in other states that would welcome them. The University of Iowa was one of those state institutions, one of those public institutions. And so,
and did the University of Iowa and other public colleges in Iowa and in the North, did they have to welcome African-American students because there weren't other colleges? We talk about historic Black colleges. Those institutions weren't here.
You are so right. For the University of Iowa, actually, there was a court case in 1867, a Supreme Court case in the state of Iowa that said they could not discriminate. But you point out another interesting part of this story, that many HBCUs needed spaces for students to get higher degrees so that they could actually have professors that could come and teach in those institutions. So that was another reason that many of these Black students sought out spaces like the University of Iowa. So the University of Iowa had been accepting African American students for many years. We had our first African American graduate in 1879. But as word of mouth spread, and I think as Dora pointed out in her own recollection, that was one reason that the pipeline grew in many ways. And then as students had experiences and received their education and went back to HBCUs, they told others. And so students continued to come.
Now, the numbers of students that came were not very many. And we have talked about the experiences of Black athletes on this program in the past. Athletics was an area where the number of African American students grew early on, because this also made, of course, the athletic programs a lot stronger. But you, the two of you, point out that it's not just the athletic programs, but the arts programs that welcomed a much higher number of African American students. Michael, why the arts?
I think that the University of Iowa is struggling to establish itself as a national and an international institution in the 1930s through the 1960s. One of the bellwether movements that takes place on this campus has to do with the movement of recognition of artistic expression for academic credit. So going back to Dean Carl Seashore and his decision ultimately to recognize academic and artistic expression as on equal par. So when you look across the nation, this is a sort of a leading edge development when you look at the University of Iowa. The University of Iowa is at the head of this kind of development. And because they need talent, when you look across all of the artistic schools at the University of Iowa, all of them are committed to a sort of colorblind framework as far as talent is concerned. And this is not an institutional mandate that comes from on high. You know, it's not a centralized bureaucratic admonition that each school is sort of developing. Rather, it's a byproduct of what has been understood as the charismatic leadership of each individual school. So when you look at figures like Mabee, when you look at figures like Engle, when you look at these folks operating within the sphere, when you look at someone like Clapp operating in the School of Music, each individual space is making decisions about how to define itself in a national and an international way at a crucial moment in the history of the university. The University of Iowa is not the University of Iowa as we understand it in the 21st century in the 1930s. I mean, in many people's mind, there is still a sense of flyover country. There is still a notion of the heartland, the yawning middle. You know, there are all kinds of epithets that are connected to it. But this is particularly acute, I feel like, in the 1930s, 1940s, 1950s. This is a moment where the university is seeking to put itself on the map. And the story of it arriving on the map has been told. But what's been fascinating and underexplored is the way that there are black collaborators that are taking place in very intimate ways in the arrival of the University of Iowa on the map. And this is the reason why I think it has so much resonance within the broader narrative of the civil rights movement and is underexplored as a dimension of the civil rights movement.
The athletes that came to campus, they had to be extraordinary athletes to be recruited, to be brought to the University of Iowa or other public institutions, and they were brought here on scholarships and, again, to enhance the athletic community. They also were very high profile on campus. With these artistic students who were coming to the theater department, to the music department, and we'll talk about the writer's workshop here in just a couple of minutes as well, were these students in some ways the equivalent of the athletes? Were they the individuals that were above and beyond everyone else in their community, Lena?
Not really. And I think that Fannie Ellison, who came here as Fannie McConnell and later married Ralph Ellison, provides a wonderful example. Fannie was actually pursuing her undergraduate degree at Fisk in Nashville. She was very happy. She was working with a luminary like James Weldon Johnson, who was a very important figure in the Harlem Renaissance. But as many students can relate to even today, she was struggling with her finances and ended up finding that she could not afford to complete her studies at Fisk, and came to the University of Iowa into the theater department, which was the Department of Speech and Dramatic Art at the time. E.C. Mabee was then the very charismatic leader and really was putting Iowa on the map as a serious space to pursue a degree in theater. But no, Fannie didn't come as some highly sought-after student. What she did come to, though, was a cutting-edge theater department. We are enjoying so many ribbon cuttings today. Well, in 1936, Iowa opened its what at that point was an amazing theater department as far as all of the bells and whistles. They were really ahead of the curve and just the technological ability. So Fannie was excited, but no, she was not in any way feted as some sort of important star student. But she worked really hard. Again, segregation was something that was happening. It wasn't official. I think in the way that Dora talks about, things weren't said directly to you, but you could not be on stage in a major performance as an African-American student. You could help. She worked in many, many plays and had good experiences with friends. But yes, she couldn't act on stage in any of the major performances and definitely went away with somewhat of a bitter taste, even though she really valued the experience and the educational opportunities she received here.
You tell so many different stories of different students in different circumstances, and obviously every student that came had a very individual experience. As we talked about earlier, this was not a large group of people. So do you feel like for a lot of the black students that they were being discouraged in their academic studies? Was there, you didn't get that sense?
No, it's actually a very interesting story in that way. Another of the students that I interviewed was Thomas Pauley, who came to pursue his master's and then went on to get a PhD. And he talks about his relationship with E.C. Mabee, who was on his dissertation committee. And actually, when Pauly came to the University of Iowa, he said he never thought of E.C. Mabee as a mentor in that way. And I think this really goes to what Michael mentioned a moment ago. What E.C. Mabee was a person who profoundly and deeply believed in the idea of regionalism, of taking this theater department and producing great scholars who could tell the story of what it was to be in the Midwest. Well, he also was a big advocate for African Americans telling their story. He thought all of us have different stories than those that are told on Broadway. So while he sometimes made racist remarks, while he was not always the kind of advocate
we'll
that you would imagine.
We'll have to pick that up in just a moment. We're talking about the new book, Invisible Hawkeyes. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'm talking with Lena and Michael Hill. They're the editors of the new book, Invisible Hawkeyes, African Americans at the University of Iowa During the Long Civil Rights Era. Also with me today, Dora Martin Berry, who studied at the University of Iowa in 1955. She was one of the people profiled in this book. And over the next few days, there are many opportunities to get in on these conversations. The event is called Fields of Opportunity and Telling of University of Iowa's Black Migration Stories. There's an event this evening at 5 o'clock called Visible Hawkeyes at Hansher Auditorium, an opportunity to learn more about these stories, participate in that event. Also tomorrow at 6:30 at Hansher Auditorium in the lobby. Lena and Michael Hill will be signing copies of the book. And there's also an opportunity on Friday at the Iowa City Public Library to participate in a scholarly panel and an alumni roundtable to talk about some of the experiences told in this book. Again, that's Friday from 3 to 6 p.m. The whole experience is called Fields of Opportunity. And Lena, just before the break, we were talking about the theater department at the University of Iowa and the fact that there were students coming from around the country, African-American students coming from around the country to this department. They weren't necessarily the kind of superstars that were brought in because we wanted a stronger athletic team and in various sports. And I had asked you if these students felt like they were discouraged academically, and you said surprisingly no.
No, and I was saying that I think that's a special part of the story, is that many of the most prominent professors and directors of these programs recognize the talent of these African-American students. And I was giving the example of Thomas Pauly, who worked a lot with E.C. Mabee. And one story he tells is that after he left, he wanted to apply to Yale to pursue his doctorate degree and called E.C. Mabee, or I think actually wrote a letter asking for a recommendation. And Mabee actually called him and said, well, I'm not going to write you a recommendation letter because I want you to return here to the University of Iowa to work on your PhD. So the story is that Pauly comes back. He's then married, and he flourishes as far as his work, but he still deals with other kinds of challenges related to living in Iowa City at a time where things were not always easy for African American students.
Now, Dora was talking about the very strong group of African American students, small but strong and supportive of each other. There was a community in Iowa City at the time, and a lot of it was focused around Bethel Church, an African Methodist Episcopal church in Iowa City. One of the people that you profile in your book, Diana Penny, came from Muscatine, but her father was involved in the church. She came to Iowa City and studied, but had moved here also with her family. That church community was vitally important to so many of these students. Can you tell us a little bit about that, Michael?
Sure. The search for institutions that ground you within what I sometimes refer to as white spaces, part of what we're understanding as far as pluralistic democracy or the notion of multiracial democracy is that as you move from segregation, a nourishing community, a set of institutions that are arrayed in a predictable fashion that you can draw upon, and you understand the social mores that are connected to them. When you integrate, as you move into spaces, especially a situation like college, which is unique in some sense, when you integrate undergraduate spaces, you're moving away from home, right? You think about Mrs. Berry's experience. You're moving 1,000 miles away from home. You're completely set adrift with regard to the institutions that are familiar to you, the spaces that you would go to for food, the spaces that you would go to for basic services, the way that you would conduct yourself in worship, the way that you would operate as far as social supports are concerned. So when you move into a space like Iowa City, when you arrive here and you're looking around, one trope that emerges is a question of housing, right? Like the literal search for a dwelling, the literal search for a domicile. I would suggest that Bethel AME constitutes a metaphorical search for home, right? Like if somebody's looking for a dwelling, if they're looking for a home, that is, I need shelter. I need a space to place myself physically.
Which
you talk about
did
churches,
have its challenges
in Iowa City. And what's fascinating there is you hear this conversation even to the present day. You know, students talking about the difficulties, students of all colors talking about the difficulties of finding housing in Iowa City, and I think is a similar situation in earlier moments. But what we find is that in the same way that there's a tax associated with blackness in certain people's minds that are connected to added difficulties, value-added difficulties, spaces like Bethel become crucial. One, for worship purposes, right, like when they're trying to adjust from a spiritual standpoint, but they also become very vital from a practical standpoint, right? Like the black church is not just there as a kind of spiritual way station that people can come to and sort of receive what they need from a soul standpoint. It also exists as a spot where you can trade knowledge, you can trade stories, people can come together and be like, oh, how did you deal with the question connected to eating? How did you deal with the question connected to lodging? How did you deal with the question connected to which professors you should take and which professors you might want to avoid at a certain moment? So I think that Bethel operates in that way. And what's fascinating about Pastor Penny's existence within the Iowa City community, and Sister Penny tells this story all the time. I don't know if she included it in the book. When they showed up in Iowa City, the congregation at Bethel had two members. Two, right? And when they walked through the door, one member was sitting there, and she said she had to come to light the stove so that they wouldn't freeze during the course of that particular interaction. So the ability of institutions to reinforce themselves and to dedicate themselves to functioning, even when they're on shoestring budgets, you know, even when they're operating with very scarce resources, becomes very crucial. And I think it reinforces that notion of the kind of solidarity. There's a notion of solidarity. There's a notion of black solidarity that will become very popular within the context of the 1960s and the context of black power. But even in the segregated era, even in earlier moments, there's a notion of black solidarity that carried those kinds of resonances that I think are very crucial when we think about what's going on.
Well, and I was struck, one of the stories, and I'm having a hard time remembering which student this was that shared this story, but she was Catholic and didn't find that community because she belonged to the wrong church. Yeah. And, you know, just how difficult that made her life at the University of Iowa to not have that kind of support. Before we run out of time, I want to talk about the Writers' Workshop because, and Michael, you wrote the chapter on the Writers' Workshop, a really interesting history of reaching out to African-American writers, but just one at a time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There's a axiomatic understanding, not only in, I think, the history of the Iowa Writers' Workshop, but also within broader African-American literary history. The notion of ascendancy of a single personality at any given point in time. The notion of genius as understood via a regime of singularity. What happens is that it's impossible for a cohort. It's impossible for a group. It's impossible for a cluster. It's impossible for three or four people to constitute genius all at one time. And I think we see it very clearly within the world of the Iowa Writers' Workshop. For whatever reason, what's fascinating about the Iowa Writers Workshop, however, is it deviates a bit from what Lena was talking about earlier. I would say that the first student that we know of, we still aren't clear because for some reason that I don't completely understand, the workshop downplays its racial accomplishments. Like it will downplay the fact that writers of a particular race were present at the workshop at a certain moment. So the reason that's relevant is because we still don't really know definitely whether Margaret Walker is the first African-American to be in the workshop because mm-hmm. the workshop won't confirm or deny whether or not she is the first person, first African-American to be at the workshop. The reason I bring up Walker, however, is that she existed within the world of the workshop as a star. She does enter with a tremendous publishing record and reputation. And Engel is very quickly moving towards a star-centered orientation. And my colleague Lauren Glass has talked about this at great length. The notion that stars will move into the world of the workshop and that the workshop will establish its reputation on the basis of stars. When Flannery O'Connor comes through, then people are like, oh, here's a star. We have a star. And the prestige of the workshop goes up in a commensurate fashion. What's fascinating about Walker's appearance is that it exemplifies that notion of antagonistic cooperation that Mrs. Berry was talking about earlier. When she comes into the workshop, there's a story that she tells about Engel lecturing her with regard to balance.
This is Paul Engel, the director of the workshop.
So Engel is saying, you need to use ballads. You need to write in a ballad form. You're too angry. You're ultimately a little bitter. Why? You know, you need to write a nice old ballad. And Walker calls him onto the carpet with regard to this particular prescription. She said, you know, you're patronizing, you know, like you're condescending, and ultimately you don't understand the power of my poetry. And Engel says, you're absolutely right. You know, he admits it. And I think that moment, you know, those kinds of moments add up, and we don't see them. They're not publicly visible. It's not something that's on the record. But in the world of invisible Hawkeyes, hopefully we can pull some of that stuff out in order that people can see that a space like the workshop had those moments, and we can catalog them, and we can start to account for them within a broader history of the institution.
Now, on the University of Iowa campus, on campuses everywhere, we still have racial issues that we are working on, we need to be working on. What, in this moment in time, do you feel like we can take away from these stories? Lena?
Well, there are a couple of things. One, I think we can just be inspired by the fact that students often made strides together, collaborating together, and I mean students, both black and white, move forward sometimes before the administrations, right? I mean, I think the election of Dora tells us that in 1955, even though it was not officially acknowledged.
The students were ahead of the institution.
The students were ahead of the institution. And also, I think that excellence matters, that many of these stories are about African-American students who made their mark both here but beyond their work at the University of Iowa, in the world, in their careers, because they came to the University of Iowa, they worked incredibly hard. They forced both their peers and their teachers and their professors to acknowledge their talent and their brilliance in their chosen fields. And that was something that could not be ignored and that allowed them to contribute not just while they were on campus, but to the HBCUs they went to teach at, and well, as well as really to the nation that was the beneficiary of those talents.
Dora, I want to ask you, because earlier we were talking about how poorly you were treated by the university after you were elected Miss State University of Iowa, and that there was never an apology issued, and your husband had some difficult experiences at the University of Iowa. You moved on, had a very successful career, but clearly you're proud of your time at the University of Iowa. How does it feel for you to have your story told right now? How does that change your feeling?
Well, you know, it really is a proud moment for me to be able to share the story with students today who are totally unaware of the history. And I'm in really good company when I listened. I read the book. I was privileged to get an advanced copy. And the more I read, the prouder I felt about what the African-American students' presence on this campus has meant over time and the tremendous contributions we as a community have made. And to be able to share that with today's students feels really good.
I think about the time that you were living in when you came to the University of Iowa, that train trip that you took with those three other students, and all the other students that you went to high school with who did not have the kind of opportunity to go on to higher education at the time. I mean, these stories tell the stories of just a few pioneers who crossed that line. How do you think about that, the other students who didn't take this path?
You know, I have an interesting answer to that question. And it's something that I make reference to in the prepared speech that I have for later today. In my high school, we had an amazing number of students who went on to achieve very, very impressive careers and to make contributions. I mean, especially when you consider we came from segregated schools, impoverished communities, but our teachers and our parents were so invested in seeing us move on to higher achievements than many of them had experienced, that it gave us something to strive for, and we were committed to making them proud.
And did you understand how high the stakes were?
At the time, of course not. At 17 years old, I mean, who does, you know? But today, looking back, I certainly do.
Michael, I'll let you have the final word as these stories go out into the world. And this week at the University of Iowa, these stories are told. What do you hope students today are going to take away from this?
I hope they view history as a toolbox, you know, as a space that holds some survival strategies, some skills for moving forward that they may not have exploited completely, that they may not have understood completely. But I also hope that the university recognizes the high quality and caliber of its collaborators. Quite often it views students in one way, and it views them from a standpoint of taking care of students, that they are somehow entrusted with the lives of students. What I hope they come to understand is that students are very skillful collaborators within the enterprise and the agenda that the university has.
Michael Hill, thank you. Lena Hill, thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.
And Dora Berry, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
We've been talking this hour about the new book, Invisible Hawkeyes, African Americans at the University of Iowa During the Long Civil Rights Era. And there are a whole bunch of events over the next 3 days at the University of Iowa, part of Fields of Opportunity, University of Iowa's Black Migration Stories. Part of this event is also that Step Africa will be at Hancher Auditorium Thursday evening at 7:30. There are a number of opportunities that you can get involved with. Panel discussions. You can listen to Dora Martin Berry tell her story as well. You can find out more online at invisiblehawkeyes.lib.uiowa.edu. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.